From VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And I'm Joanna Sciarrino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the VinePair podcast. Before we kick things off, I want to thank you guys because for like the last 20 minutes before we started recording, we just were chatting like about the episode and what we're going to record today and stuff like that. And it really let the espresso kick in. And I want to thank you so much. It's fully in my bloodstream now. I'm ready to go.
The critical activation period.
Yeah, I'm feeling really amped for today. So
wait, you mean you didn't drink an adaptogen soda before instead?
No. Oh. But if you want to hear one of my other fucking pet peeves about shit, because, you know, I like to complain.
Let's go.
I really don't love when there is... I have a really big love-hate relationship with Think Coffee on the first floor of our building.
Oh,
where, like, whatever, they're a huge company. Now I can call out Think. Where, like, you have espresso cups sitting on top of the machine. And I specifically...
Like ceramic ones.
Ones. Yeah. And every time I go, I specifically ask for an espresso in the cup.
Mm-hmm.
And you always give it to me in a paper fucking cup. And I'm sorry, but the paper cup does make the coffee taste like shit. There is something about like
it's also wasteful.
Yes, number one, yeah, that's exactly why I do it. And number two, it's because it like the coffee absorbs this weird paper flavor that it doesn't take. Maybe it's their cheap ass cups. I don't know, think cutting costs or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like, come on, guys. And the only reason I keep going to you is because the other better coffee shop is a block and a half away, and I just don't have the time.
Well, the problem is if you'd had the espresso before you needed the espresso, you would walk faster, but you haven't had the espresso yet, so you got to resort to Think. No,
I mean, I can go downstairs right there.
I'm a huge fan of drinking coffee in general out of ceramic mugs and whatever the drink. And I agree with you. It is deeply infuriating to me where if I go to a place and ask for it in a mug and they just are like, oh, here's your paper cup of whatever. I'm just like, why? You have them.
Yeah,
it's not COVID anymore. I can have
exactly. It pisses me off. You have it, and then I've learned my lesson, which is I don't say anymore, oh, I wanted that ceramic, because all they do is go, okay, thump, and just, like, dump it in. I'm like, so now we've wasted the cup, and so I'm just like...
You lost some of that espresso, too.
Whatever. I asked you. You didn't do it. I saw you push something on the computer that I think meant to tell the barista on the receipt ceramic, but clearly, whatever. Anyways, Joanna, what have you been reading?
I really liked Maggie Hennessy's most recent piece on the site about sake. And this piece was, yes, it is. It's a very interesting thing, as we've discussed in the past. But basically, her piece explores why we have like a bias against hot sake, I think, obviously, because most
sake, bomb, bomb, bomb.
Right. So, yes, exactly. I think, and how like, if you have good quality sake, it can be served at different temperatures to kind of bring out the nuances and some of the flavors and it changed the drinking experience. And what this piece really highlighted for me is that there's just such a lack of education around sake, and we have these very fixed perceptions of how it's supposed to be, you know, consumed, when it's supposed to be consumed. I also think what's really interesting about the piece is like she talks about how people have this understanding that like hot sake is bad quality. But I also think that a lot of people only know sake as hot sake and they have no idea of the quality, like what that means for the quality too. So I really liked her piece. What about you, Adam?
So I'm going to go back to last week. and I was the end of the week and I really enjoyed the piece No Sparklers Please Has Bottle Service Fizzled Out.
Melissa Rich.
Yeah, and I thought that was really interesting because I've had this conversation with other people that really, like, first of all, the only places that seem to still be doing bottle service at all is, like, basically Vegas and a little bit Miami, and it seems that, like, the brands haven't caught on to this still. Like, there's brands that are launching, including from, like, really big, you know, like SKUs companies are launching from really big brands where like part of their campaign is like nightlife bottle service and like going into clubs, like carrying their bottle with the sparkler outside of it and stuff, like trying to, you know, a lot of the 1942 chasers are doing this, et cetera. And it's like, guys, like no one thinks this is cool anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is not actually cool. Like you're late to this. Don't do this. You know, yes, that is how 42 and other brands were being served 10 years ago when they were coming on the scene, but like it's not cool anymore. Like people want these way more understated luxury experiences, and like they still want to spend money, but they want to do it in a very different way. And I thought that that was a fascinating article that was like, yeah, come on, man. It's about damn time that we just start admitting this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, stop it. Stop it.
Yeah.
But you know where bottle service is cool now?
Where?
Like Auburn, Alabama. You know what I mean? Like, it's, I don't think anyone's doing it, and it's not even cool there. Like, college bars probably may, I don't know, are they doing bottle service? I don't, it's just, it's actually just not cool anymore.
It's not cool.
It's not
cool. It still happens.
But it's
of course,
like, you,
but, like, it's not cool.
It is not cool anymore.
Yeah.
At all.
Was it ever cool? I don't know.
At a point, in, a, mo- in
that
a moment.
Succession, it, that Succession scene.
Yeah.
That was so funny.
Exactly. But, like, in a moment, as she says, like, when Brittany and Lindsay and, like, the Hilton sisters
Paris,
were
yeah.
all out. Like, that was at the moment that it was considered somewhat cool, I think.
Yeah.
And where, like, the night, like, the club felt like a place where you were going to be seen, but then you could be completely private. Now, like, it's just kind of to go to those clubs in general is not very cool anymore. And the whole service thing isn't very cool. So I thought that was a really fun piece and quite enjoyed it. And then I thought, you know, Aaron's piece on just Foursquare rum and how it's sort of taking over in terms of cask finishing with whiskey was really interesting as well. He always has these really unique angles that he always happens to find that other people don't, which I enjoyed.
Yeah.
What about you, Zach?
Well, you know, the thing that captivated me the most on the site, and it's not going to come as a huge surprise because it, I think, captivated a lot of everyone's attention, was Martini Madness. And I got to say, when I first got wind of this idea, I was like, I don't know, like tournaments, whatever. Okay. I get that. Obviously, the timing is ideal and the martini is still very, very popular. But I got to be honest, like, and I don't say this lightly, like, I found this content incredibly interesting from 3,000 miles away. Now, admittedly, I have had a few of these martinis, but certainly nowhere near all of them like the rest of you. And I got to say, like, I think it was a really cool idea. I think the sort of range of different bars and restaurants and styles of martini represented was really cool. Because, again, I think when I first heard about this, I was like, I mean, yeah, martinis are not all the same, but kind of is this going to be like – are these going to be hard to distinguish? And even in the among the ones that I've tasted of these, I think there is a lot of variation. And certainly there's a lot of things on here that go even further beyond the sort of most stereotypical vision of a martini, but are still, you know, kind of true to the concept. So, I mean, I really wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about this, kind of like where did the idea come from?
Oh, gosh, this was, I think, the first year where we remembered March Madness was a thing with enough time to do anything about it.
Okay.
I'm so serious. Every year we're like, oh, shit, it's March Madness next week and we have to do something. It's too late to do a cool bracket.
Yeah.
But we, I think we were thinking about it back in either end of the year or early January. We were like, we have enough time, put together this bracket, like, really, we sat down and came up with, obviously, like you mentioned, like, the martini is having a moment just beyond the fact that it's an amazing classic cocktail, but bars are being so inventive with their takes on it. So I do think that it afforded us, you know, the opportunity for this to be much more compelling than just like we went and had dry gin martinis at every bar in the city, which would have been a little bit flat. So, yeah, we sat down. We were like, okay, we don't think we can do 64 because that'll absolutely kill us.
Yeah, 64 is a lot.
It's also hard to come up with like 64 solid, yeah, like martinis that felt buzzy, that felt intentional, you know, instead of just being like, well, here's a bar and we'll just get a martini
yeah,
there.
Yeah, that bar would be like sort of what happens to, you know, the 16th seeds.
Yeah.
I was like, they're going to lose. Like, they're mostly going to lose in the first round.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And so we came up with 32 and we figured we'd just time it along with the tournament and, you know, divided up the places among the editorial team members and kind of had at it. We went to these places on our own without making reservations or letting anybody know we were coming and, paid our way. When we launched the bracket, we had a lot of bars like DMing us being like, let us know when you want to come in. And we were like, actually,
we've already come in.
We've already done this. Yes. And then it was just, yeah, we spent the last couple of weeks just, you know, whittling down to our champion.
So one thing I think is really interesting is that one of the things that I uncovered through this, which is totally separate from the actual package, but it's related to what you just said,
yeah,
which is it's always fascinating to me the bars that research who their guests are and the bars who don't. So you guys went into all of these, right, and were unannounced. But I heard from multiple people on the editorial team that they were either recognized or after they were in and paid, that then the bar reached back out and like, thank you for coming in. And it was maybe like a fourth to a third of the bars.
Yeah.
And I will say it was a majority of the bars, not this had nothing to do with it, but like that kind of made it pretty far in the finals, because you can tell like that's also their approach to hospitality.
Yep.
Right. Is like we want to know who you are when you come in. We want to give you very specific service, et cetera. And like, that's just, it's always been so fascinating to me. And so this is for a different conversation, but on Monday when we had our after hours here, talking to Souther Teague about that, that his perspective has always been like, you're given a menu within 10 seconds of walking into Amoria Margo, and you are, no, you're greeted within 10 seconds of walking into Amoria Margo, and you're given a menu within 30 seconds. And right. Every bartender on his staff knows that that's his rule, and he knows who's been there, what you're up to. Like, they follow up with you, they talk to you. Really interesting. Anyways, continue.
Yeah, I do think that it wasn't one of the explicit things we were rating the martinis on, but I do think that the overall experience that we had at these places did factor into yeah. how you reflect on a drink, right? And I think because we were because we had 32 places in mind, it did range from like the really, really buzzy places that are packed and have lines out the door to like the classic places like Keen's, where hospitality there is like a very specific thing. It's not like quite Peter Luger-esque, right, where they're going to like throw the menu at you and not give a shit about you. But, you know, it's just like it's a little brusque. It's right. not
that's
quite.
That's their thing.
Yeah, that's their thing. It's an institution, right? And so I think that while we didn't like rate on the hospitality at these places specifically, I do think that informed how we reflected on the drinks.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have a couple more questions. For each of you, were there any like particular surprises in the bracket? Like you thought either after the first round or kind of just in sitting down and laying this out, wow, I really thought this place would go further, or alternatively, I didn't really think that this place would be, you know, kind of up there in the top couple of martinis in the city. Were there any surprises in that regard?
Well, I think one of the biggest surprises for me that I told Joanna on Monday when the whole thing finally debuted, right, I had been following along, is this, what I loved about this was pretty much, you know, the way we did the bracket sort of reflected in a lot of ways, even like how the NCAA seeds, and you know, in terms of like, sometimes you just get a lucky draw. Mm-hmm. And like, there's a lot of arguments being made, mostly by myself and my fellow fans, that Alabama got a really easy draw this year. And that's the whole reason they made it to the Final Four, because, you know, fuck Bama. But but like that is something that's often talked about in the tournament, is yeah. like who gets an easy draw. So one of the ones that I thought about very quickly was like Gage and Tolner.
Yeah.
And it was up against
Maison Premier.
And I was like, I think the Gage and Tolner's martini is really great and really classic. And the bar program, right? This is St. John's cocktail.
Yeah, it's
program.
One of the ones I've had with you, in yeah. fact.
Right. And he's considered to be like one of the best bartenders in the city. Like, but it's Maison Premier, right. And they yeah. won the whole thing.
It's a tough match,
so it's like
up, yeah.
that just kind of sucks it in the first. Like that was a bar that like probably would have made it much deeper depending on who they would have initially been up against.
Right.
And so that was just very interesting to me as you follow along. As like a lot of it was, yes, do I think that ultimately probably the best martini in the city won 100%. But there were other people that could have made it further had they not initially been up against the Maison Premiers of the world, or 11 Madison Park, which kind of came out of nowhere.
Right.
For a lot of people.
It comes on if they're on different sides of the bracket,
exactly.
too, right? Yeah, I something I think about a lot with this, and just like reflecting on it as a package, and if we do others in the future, is like for this, we tried to pick the most iconic drink or martini version from the bar. Mm-hmm. And so for some, that was like it was a Gibson, right?
Right.
The Dear Irving Gibson is what one of the drinks that they're known for, but we didn't necessarily match up a Gibson for a Gibson,
right.
you know, or a Vesper for a Vesper. And I think, you know, was that fair? But also I don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, I care. It was all very subjective, and I still feel really good about how this came out, but I think about that too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Two more quick questions, because yes. I remain fascinated. The first is, I think it was an interesting and I will say, I think, correct decision to have this be editorial as opposed to, like, I don't know, people voting or whatever. Yeah, I think you tend to see these kinds of brackets, and I think they tend to fall apart kind of as a both as a concept and sort of as an accurate-ish judge of quality when you do the, like, okay, now everyone go to this website and click who you think should win or whatever, because it becomes a thing that's lobbied for, and it's more about which bars have the best social media reach and all that kind of stuff. Was it from the get-go very clear, like, this is going to be a purely editorial decision as opposed to, I don't know, like I said, some amount of fan voting?
Yes, it was always going to be an editorial thing, because we were like, part of its appeal, I think, was that we would have all of these martinis, and that's what a, you know, crazy project that would be. I only actually thought about, like, fan voting after the fact, where I was like, oh, I see most brands approach this by just, like, having people vote instead. Yeah. We would have had to do far less work if we approached it that way. But I also think that, like you said, I think it was actually ultimately a good decision, because, I don't know, like, this is our expertise, right, in the drink space and the city where our office is based and where we go out drinking most often. So, yeah.
Also, like, not to sound like a snob, but I'm going to.
When has that ever stopped you?
Yeah, Adam.
I actually think, like, hearing from bartenders, et cetera, it actually caused them to take this more seriously in terms of following along than just the voting. So, like, okay, cool. So such and such bar got all their fucking patrons to vote and they made it to, like, the final four. And then the other bar that won was just because they got all their patrons to vote. Like, who cares?
Right.
Whereas, like, this, they all knew was 100% editorial. And we had explained throughout the process how this all had worked, that we had gone in, we hadn't told anybody, we paid for the drinks, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so I think people were like, oh, wow, like, this is actually something to take seriously and really pay attention to. It was very different, I think, than if we had done it the other way.
Yeah, and we did see, so, like, the bars who were included in this were really engaging with the project, and that was really awesome to see, especially when the first bracket went out.
Yeah.
So that was super exciting.
And my last question.
Yeah.
So what's next?
We've had people.
Somebody asked us to do a Negroni one.
Yeah, I saw that.
It's like, oh.
Someone has to do a Negroni one. Someone else has asked for an espresso martini one.
Mm-hmm. Adam is not going to be a part of the editorial team on that one. I mean, doesn't it have to be the Manhattan?
The question is, are there enough places making a Manhattan that are on their menus? Right? Like, that's the big question, whereas, like, a lot of places are putting some kind of version of an espresso martini or some kind of version of a Negroni on their menus.
Okay. Fair enough.
So, like, that's the big question is, like, what other drink do we think? I mean, the other thing, maybe margarita.
Old fashioned. Oh, margarita's a good one.
That
actually.
Kind of stuff. But yeah, it would have to be something where, like, enough places are doing some kind of version of this drink on their menu.
Yeah.
And the martini is also just so, like, maybe we just redo the martini next year. Who knows? We'll see. But speaking of sort of this whole experience and kicking into our topic today, one of the things that I thought was really surprising, or people told me they were surprised by, was that one of the two finalists was not a bar but a restaurant, 11 Madison Park. And I've had a lot of people say to me recently, especially when I was judging a cocktail competition a few weeks ago, that, like, they think there is a very big difference between restaurant cocktails and cocktail bar cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
And that the cocktails made for a restaurant are usually they're either classics or they are simple, so that there can be more of those cocktails pushed out for service at night. It's easier because the bartender there is usually also being told to open wines, pour beers, etc. And that the expectation of the consumer should be that when you have a cocktail at a restaurant, you should not immediately assume it should be at the same creativity and quality as at a cocktail bar.
Mm-hmm.
But then 11 Madison Park was a finalist. That being said, it is a 3 Michelin star restaurant, so it's a kind of different world. But I'm curious what but the Bonnie's Martini made it pretty far.
Yeah.
So I'm curious what you both think. Is there a difference between restaurant cocktails and cocktail bar cocktails, and should we treat them differently and have different expectations?
I think the answer to this is yes, and it has only grown wider as a discrepancy or as a difference. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that has been driven by cocktail bars, which understandably have felt the need to kind of justify their existence by doing more and different things with cocktails than almost any restaurant can really do. And I think I want to make a couple of points here. The first is that, you know, 11 Madison Park is a restaurant, yes, but it's not exactly your neighborhood diner. Like it is a restaurant with a three Michelin star restaurant with an enormous, you know, kind of kitchen team, and that allows them to do a lot of things at the cocktail bar that are kind of culinary driven that a lot of restaurants just don't have the space and the labor to do. And this is true, you know, there are places around the country like this that have really elaborate cocktail programs and are restaurants, but because the restaurant program is very elaborate and has a lot of prep and stuff involved, it kind of gives the bar team the opportunity to do things that you might often see in cocktail bars. And I think a lot about this in terms of the first instance where I really noticed this divergence between cocktail bars and what they were doing and restaurants and what they were doing was with like the fat washing craze from, I don't know, maybe 12 or 14 years ago or something like that, where it was the first kind of drink that in my eyes hit enough, got enough public attention, that got enough kind of bartender attention, where there was a real clear dividing line between the restaurants that were like, you know what, this is not a thing we're going to be able to manage, right? We don't have the ability to, we might have the raw ingredients, we certainly have lots of fat, but we don't have the kind of committed bar staff. We're not having our bartenders come in 3 hours, 4 hours before service to do prep for days in advance. Like our bartender's prep is juicing citrus. That's like the extent of it, cutting garnish, et cetera, right? We're not having someone come in to do all of this extra work. And not to say no restaurants did that, some did, but the overwhelming number of restaurants, even those with quite good bar programs, were like, took a look at that and were like, this ain't for us. And cocktail bars, on the other hand, have kind of only further moved in that direction, right? There's a lot of cocktails on cocktail bar menus that require days worth of prep. You know, sometimes it's in, or months in some cases, you know, it's not just infusions, which are pretty passive, but it's a lot of active technique, a lot of just, you know, things that require a lot of prep time. And restaurants generally are not set up to accommodate that in the bar. They might do it in the kitchen, depending on the kind of restaurant. So I think that divergence has only grown. And again, it's because restaurants upped their cocktail game in a lot of cases. And people, when given the choice, would often, if you're going for a straightforward kind of made to order cocktail, well, why wouldn't you go somewhere that also has an in-depth food menu and maybe great food, as opposed to a cocktail bar, which is going to lean much more heavily on, you know, kind of simple foods and maybe just less interesting food. And there you're really there for the cocktails. And I think these elaborate cocktails, these heavy prep intensive cocktails, have been the cocktail industry and the cocktail bar industry's response to that.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, the first thing I thought of when you mentioned this is that clarified cocktail that you had at a restaurant that you hated.
Yep.
So expectations there.
Yeah.
But
I think that's probably part of the, you know, it's clearly a trend, as Zach said, like fat washing.
Yeah.
That's now places are doing at restaurants, but like maybe shouldn't be.
Right.
But it's a easier trend they can pick up on than like doing some of the crazy like sous vide shit and stuff you're seeing still being done at actual cocktail bars. But they think they can also maybe charge a premium for whatever, but they're not doing it well.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that unless you can really deliver on an elaborate cocktail menu at a restaurant, then you should just keep it very basic. Like, and unless you're like an EMP where you're actually investing in a really robust like beverage program and bar program, then yeah, I think it should be pared down and just really good. Too, right? And then but I understand why restaurants don't want to do that. They want to have, you know, cocktails that are appealing where they can charge more money for them. Like I guess Manhattan's kind of the same, but they have a really elaborate bar program, but you know, it's a restaurant too. But I think they deliver on their cocktails.
I think they have a very I think the difference though too is like with some of these places, like they have a very distinct bar area as well.
Yeah, that's
like
a good point.
Like more of what I'm thinking of is like the majority of restaurants now, especially like in Brooklyn, right, where there's a bar with like maybe three or four seats, and it's really there. If like you're not going there to also potentially drink and to get drink, you never go there and be like, hey, let's grab drinks at X place after work. Whereas a lot of people go to Manhattan just to get drinks after work. A lot of people go to EMP. It's like this secret people talk about. I'm like, oh, you go to EMP and just have drinks and like, you know, and it's a very separate area of the restaurant, right? Where this is where the bar is. And so they're operating them almost like bars inside of restaurants, like, you know, standalone bars inside of restaurants.
Yep.
I'm talking about more of these places that are, yeah, like the bar is there, kind of amidst the hustle and bustle of the restaurant.
Yeah.
And that's also where, you know, another bartender friend of mine was saying, if you are a bartender, and she was a restaurant bartender and then left for cocktail bar bartender, because she said often, like, you're making really delicious drinks, but they are usually simpler. Like, you're taking shortcuts. So, for example, you know, she said, you know, in a cocktail that she had made at the time, like, she was using capsaicin bitters, as opposed to like infusing or playing with actual mole chili. Or spices or chilies,
yeah.
to get that flavor, because it was faster. They could order it for the restaurant. She could add some spice to this one cocktail she was making that was like a sort of like spicier martini, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of trying to play with like infusing a gin or playing with a vermouth or things like that, that she would have potentially done at a cocktail bar when she has the time, she has the staff, they can help her. Like, she basically was saying too, like, she's doing a lot more. There's no real, like, you don't have like dedicated bar backs in the same way. You have like your bussers and stuff who are doing everything for the entire restaurant.
Right.
Right. So there were people coming in to also like help her with prep. She was coming in to do the prep. It's like, well, what shortcuts can I take? Which means that the cocktails become more simple, which is fine as long as they're still delicious. But then, you know, when you judge that against the craft, et cetera, that goes into some of these cocktail bar cocktails, it's just, it's hard to say that they're equal in terms of, you know, preparation.
Yeah.
And I think,
and what do you think about price in that instance then?
Well, so I think that what restaurants get away with is that you're captive. And if you want to have a cocktail and you're used to already paying these prices anyways, even if you're at a, you know, even though you're there not at a cocktail bar, you'll still pay the same kind of similar price because they've got you there for their food.
Right.
Right? So they're like, well, we know you want like a really great, you know, clarified rum cough syrup before your meal. So therefore, like, we're still going to charge you $18 to $20, even though you could go around the corner to Rockwell Place and get an actually really well-made cocktail. You're not going to do that. You're going to come here. Maybe you'll go there afterwards.
After,
but like,
yeah,
if you want a cocktail with your meal, you're going to pay what we're selling.
Charging. Yeah.
And I think you also have this other challenge too for restaurants in particular, which is, you know, the cocktails, at least in theory, and everything in the restaurant should be in some sense in service to the food if it's a quality,
yep,
restaurant, right? And
yeah,
you can't necessarily, I mean, part of the thing about a lot of these craft cocktail drinks is that they themselves are complex enough. I mean, the whole point of doing all that shit to the drink, especially beforehand, is to create a more complex beverage than you can get from just pouring three or four ingredients into a mixing glass and stirring it, right? Or whatever. And so if you're delivering all that subtlety and nuance and complexity, the last thing you want is like a bunch of food getting in the way of that drink. I mean, you should probably have some food, I mean, to be clear.
Right.
But I think that there is a kind of chicken egg thing here, right? Where a cocktail bar presumably first and foremost exists to serve the cocktails, and the cocktails should be the star of the show. They should be the thing that is focused on. And if there is food at all, it should be relatively simple, straightforward food that is just there to kind of provide a little bit of contrast and, you know, calories. And in a restaurant, most of the time you're there for the food, or the whole yep, experience at least. And those pieces need to blend together better. And I think the truth is that if I think about some of the most elaborate, interesting, kind of even great cocktails I've had at really nice cocktail bars, I don't really want to sit at a table with my friends and drink them while I'm eating dinner. Like, that does not sound appealing to me. And so I think, you know, I want to be clear here, because I think there can be at times when we say things like simple or basic, that comes across as being less than. And I don't think that's true. I actually think making great drinks, you know, a la minute to order from just, you know, simple ingredients is actually a very difficult skill. And especially when doing that with, you know, trying some degree of creativity, trying to come up with new and interesting drinks that only work from mostly pre-existing ingredients is not easy to do. And I think that sometimes a lot of prep and a lot of technique is, I don't want to say a kind of mask for a lack of anything. It's just, it's a different kind of process. It's a different kind of project. In the same way, and I think I may have used this exact analogy before on the pod, so I apologize if I'm repeating myself. But in a lot of ways, I am more impressed with someone who can cook a very, very delicious dish from essentially fresh ingredients only, as opposed to someone who can create a beautiful, elaborate, complex, interesting dish, but it took them 7 days to do it and 30 hours of labor to get it right. That's not to say I won't enjoy that dish. That dish is probably great, but it's impressive in a different way. And I think that, you know, again, in this conversation, I want to be clear that restaurant bartending and bartending where you are working with less in the way of support, less in the way of time, is really challenging. And I think when done well, as impressive as anything that, you know, these sort of bespoke cocktail bars are doing too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Looking back at our bracket, though, it seems that the only restaurants that moved forward were the ones where they had the dedicated bar programs.
Yeah.
Like, we did have, like I mentioned, Keen's is a steakhouse. Different, the drinks are great there, but it's just it's a different experience, right?
So I think it's twofold, right? It's a dedicated bar program, and they've invested in someone who's either made a name for themselves elsewhere.
Sure.
Or is making a name for themselves as a really prominent bartender. And look, at that point in time, then, here's the other thing, right? Then you got to kind of share the limelight with the chef, and the chef's got to want to share the limelight with you, because the place becomes known for the drinks program in a lot of these places. Okay, not EMP, but also, I don't know what Daniel Hume's ego is like, so who knows, he made. But, like, you know, at a 3 Michelin star place, the guy's gotten all his flowers, right? So... But at some of these other places that are buzzy, like a Bonnie's,
yeah,
right? Like, you do have to share the spotlight with Channing. Mm-hmm. And he has gotten a ton of press from us and from other places because he's a very talented bartender. And so, you know, that some places may not want that. It's about the chef and their vision, et cetera. And, like, you make the drinks that go, as Zach's saying, they go with my food.
Yeah.
And, like, that's it. I'm not trying to get press also for your drinks.
Yeah.
And... I think that's a really interesting thing, right? That's always been the tension between even, like, chefs and the wine professionals, right? I'm not trying to get pressed for your fucking list.
Yeah.
Like, you open wines that make us money. I don't need your ego here. It's my restaurant. I'm the chef. And so I think that's a really interesting thing to think about. And I think the reason, though, there are so many restaurants on this list, or not so many, but there are restaurants, it's like the martini is one of the cocktails that is perfect for both and can either super elaborate or really solid. And, like, that, I think in the restaurant game, the best thing to do is, as you said, play the hits. You know, make really solid versions of the classics, and then with a little bit of variation. And most people are going to be more than happy to pay the prices that are the going rate in their market, right? If I said 18 or 20, I'm going to get emails from people who live in Des Moines being like, we don't pay that for cocktails, although maybe they do now. But, you know, I think
Boise.
Whatever your going rate is,
you let it pass. It was more than you would think, but we'll get there sometime.
Exactly. So, you know, I think that's kind of the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, the martini is a perfect restaurant cocktail too, because it's such a great food companion.
Yes. Like, yes.
Right. All those classics, sort of the Negroni, the Manhattan, that have also that sort of, you know, the drying effect with the drink that really keep your palate ready to go. Mm-hmm. Those are great. Restaurant drinks,
yeah.
You know, and then, yeah, I don't know, like the what we did for after hours this week with Tiki Mondays of Brian Miller. Like, mm-hmm. I thought the drinks were some of the best I've had in a very long time, mm-hmm. but, like, I don't know if all of them would be restaurant drinks, right? Like, they were very, very complex, rich, maybe the old fashioned, but, like, the other two, I mean, the first one was literally his version of a painkiller that he called the pain reliever, was like a meal in a glass. We were all talking about it tasting like the most delicious milkshake you've ever had. I don't know if that's something that I want along with a lot of the cuisine you would go out to have.
But that's also like, I feel like tiki or tropical drinks often don't feature at restaurants.
Exactly.
I think about Lani Kai being one example, right? Because that was a restaurant.
Yeah.
Was this Julie Reiner?
I think
Lani
so.
Kai was Julie Reiner? Yeah, that place was awesome. But that was one example where the tiki and tropical drinks actually were meant to go with the fare.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, let us know what you think. Hit us up at podcast@vinepair.com. Give us your opinions. Do you think there's a difference between the restaurant drinks, drinks, cocktails?
Or your expectations restaurant.
Yeah, your expectations and cocktail bars.
Are you going to complain about the clarified cocktail at the restaurant?
Like me? Look, here's the deal, man. Let me do it.
No one stops you ever, so.
That's fine. It's fine. I don't know what that's supposed to mean. I feel like that's a little dig. It's fine.
Joanna getting in right at the end of the episode.
Yeah. Huh. Nice.
Talk to you next week.
Noted. Peace. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Jabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.